Hello, and welcome to the AgTech So What podcast. Emerging technologies are rapidly changing the global agricultural industry, and we believe that this revolution is only getting started. But there's still too much hype out there and too big of a disconnect between ag and ag tech. So on this show, we try to bridge that gap. In each episode, we bring you the story of a different innovator in agriculture and try to find the place where ag and tech meet. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. Today's episode is the third in the theme, Responding to Climate Risk, brought to you in partnership with the Australian Farm Institute. Check out episodes 42 and 44 to hear more about responding to climate risk. Today's guest is Ben Krasnestein, co-founder and managing director of Kalara Capital, a company that helps facilitate investment opportunities that provide a commercial return together with carbon drawdown and emission reduction outcomes. Ben has over 20 years experience across legal, advisory, commercial transactions, and deal structuring in various industry sectors. Ben has always been conscious of the global economy's impact on the environment, and over the years, he's seen the potential for business to play a role in the shift toward positive change.
I really felt that there was a disconnect with the way that we were relating as a global community to land and the way that our economies have been structured for so long. It's all been around extraction and consuming, rather than around regenerating and prosuming. And that's something that in this current business, I really want to drive forward. Can we create and how do we create opportunities for investment and for outcomes and for community and for environment that are not uncommercial, in fact, they're inherently commercial, but that also focus on improving the very ground or planet upon which we operate. Because my belief is that in this transition to a low carbon world, there are massive opportunities for economic growth, employment, community development, wealth creation, potentially the likes of which we haven't seen since the Industrial Revolution.
While Ben is positive about the future, he acknowledges that there are still some major hurdles to overcome.
One of the issues that we face, I suppose, is that politically and through certain media channels, this transition is portrayed as a negative or a cost-bearing problem. It's just not the case at all in our view. We just think that there are huge opportunities, and I think the global community recognises that as well. It's just a really important shift that we need to make, and we do it, and we can make it in a way that provides for growth, but growth that's starting to give back to the natural capital that we've used. We've used up our budget, and we now need to start figuring out how we can deliver growth without doing that anymore.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that kind of perception issue. And is the current work you're doing still seen as a bohemian in some way, to use that original term, and kind of a fluffy hippie kind of thing, or focused on costs? Or have you kind of seen the space changing from an investment perspective?
Over the last 5 years in particular, it's changed a lot. I still think there is a big perception that you have to be, you know, having a scarf on your head and a beard and a hippie shirt on. But it's just not the case at all. And I think more and more people are starting to understand what that looks like. And the carbon investments that we're making as a segue is probably a really good example of it.
Ben has two examples of companies that are challenging the model that commercial returns and impact are at odds. The first is a company called Climate Friendly.
They are a business that try to deliver multiple income and productivity benefits for land management or agricultural activity. So landowners or agricultural businesses that own larger assets across the country. So, you know, the example there is farmers or agricultural producers or foresters or traditional custodians who run significant size properties tapping into carbon farming activities. So carbon farmers, in inverted commas, either remove carbon from the atmosphere and store it in the land, or prevent greenhouse gases from entering the atmosphere in the first place. And there's a number of approved methods that have been set out and validated by the federal government pursuant to federal initiatives, which allow those farmers and landowners to access income streams.
If I'm a farmer and I want to use Climate Friendly or get involved, what's an example?
So an example is one of the largest methodologies which is used under the government's fund is called human-induced regeneration. So that's allowing and facilitating the regeneration, for example, of native bush across large areas of one's land to simply grow back, sequester carbon as a result, and revegetate large swathes of land. And there's a methodology that exists pursuant to the federal regulations which says that if you do that across a certain number of hectares, That equates to a certain amount of CO2e, carbon dioxide equivalent. And the price for a ton of CO2e is X dollars. And for the amount of CO2e that you either sequester or avoid, in this case sequester, we will pay you. That's the government scheme in a nutshell. And the way that that scheme works is that the farmer, or in this case Climate Friendly on behalf of the farmer, will approach the government and say, we have an initiative here which fits the methodology. We estimate that this farmer will be able to deliver 1,000 tonnes of CO2e per annum. Usually it's a lot more than that, but just using a number. And that farmer is prepared to receive a price for that carbon of X dollars. And it's done on a reverse auction basis out of the government's emissions reduction fund, now recoined and rephrased, I think, the Climate Solutions Fund, into which the government's put $2 billion previously and has said they'll put another $2 billion. So essentially what that is the government paying for emissions reductions outcomes. Government are saying, here's $2 billion or now another $2 billion. The lowest bidder into that auction process, which happens, I think, once every 3 or 4 months, will receive the contract. We guarantee to pay that amount for 10 years to you, Mr. Farmer, so long as you allow the native bush to grow back, putting it simply, and don't touch it, and don't cut it down, and don't clear it. And there's a very, very reliable income stream, therefore, which flows to the farmer. The business like Climate Friendly acts as the procurer and enabler of that to happen. So the farmer himself or herself, or the corporate who may not be proficient in doing so, is able to tap into that revenue stream, and Climate Friendly then sits in the middle and makes sure that the contracts are negotiated properly, that the process and the compliance and the auditing and the monitoring each year happens precisely, and that the farmer is actually delivering on the amount of carbon that they should be, and then they get paid a certain amount per ton for doing so. So it's a simple way of describing the business model, and it's a very reliable income stream, clearly. It's a government-backed revenue stream that goes to the farmer, and Climate Friendly clips the ticket, if you like.
Consumers especially, but us all generally wanting, you know, better environmental outcomes, I would say there's two challenges. One is around making it economically possible for farmers, and when we talk about, you know, being climate change resilient and transitioning to a carbon neutral economy, you know, we have to make it profitable, like the dollars and cents have to add up. And the other is around the kind of validation and verification of practices, like wanting to have more than just a belief that good practices are being done, but actually have some kind of data or confidence that good practices are being done. Do you have any comments generally on that? And it sounds like you're solving at least the economic viability question, but maybe not the kind of data verification aspect of it.
Yeah, very good question. Firstly, the systems that are set up to ensure that these emissions reductions outcomes are occurring on land are science-based, sometimes too scientific in a sense, because the methodologies that the government has put in place are too complex and too difficult for farmers to create carbon from those processes. So there is a problem there in terms of sometimes there's too much verification required. And the soil carbon methodology is an example of that, where we think there needs to be some relaxation of the way in which that method is able to generate the credit, the Australian Carbon Credit Unit, because there are enormous outcomes occurring on land on various different projects that we know about that are not able to be monetized because of the difficulty in creating that unit. It's too expensive, essentially, because we're talking now in basic terms about creating a unit of something. And if you can't create a unit of something in a cost-effective manner, then you can't monetize it because you can't sell it in a cost-effective manner or for a cost-effective price. And that's really what I think it's important for people to remember. We are creating units of carbon.
What you're saying is basically that it can be too expensive for farmers to do the practice they need to do to get enough carbon, for example, in the soil, where they can actually sell that carbon credit. And so the practice needs to become less expensive, or you need to pay them more.
That's almost exactly right. The only tweak to that comment, Sarah, is that it's not so much that it's expensive to create the soil carbon. It can be in some practices, but it's not so much that it's expensive to create the soil carbon. It's expensive to measure it and monitor it in a way that the government will then say, that's valid and I'll pay you for it. There's a lot of farmers out there today who are actually demonstrating that they are developing soil carbon, but in order for them to get paid by the government, they've got to go around, and here's the example, and take soil samples from every 100 metres or 100 square metres, which is just simply impractical across 10,000 hectares. That's a crude way of saying it. not necessarily the numbers, but that's the point. There needs to be a way to actually monetize the carbon that we know is being created in a much more effective way, because it's too expensive to produce that unit if you've got to go and pay for soil samples across 10,000 hectares every 100 metres.
And what do you see as the solutions, or are you seeing solutions to this? You know, one that strikes me is satellite imagery and the ability to use some of the advanced technologies to solve that problem.
Indeed, in other parts of the world, Canada is an example where there are some companies that have developed very efficient methods of analysing that data. But indeed, I think the regulations over there allow the creation of, for example, soil carbon, if we're on that topic, via the use of data rather than the use of soil sampling. Again, that's the crude way of looking at the problem. If indeed we had a system here that was scientifically based that allowed us to map a baseline across a certain part of farmers' land initially and say, okay, there's that much soil carbon in there now, let's use data and let's use technology to then go and measure that over time. That is an example where technology can leap into this to help and drive the change. And there's a lot of technology that's around there that can assist us in doing that. But, you know, that's only, Sarah, in relation to the soil carbon issue. But I think it's worth mentioning and highlighting the soil carbon issue, because soil is our sponge. We can hold 3 times more carbon in the soil than there is in the atmosphere today. So it is an enormous store of carbon, and is an enormous potential storer of carbon if we get it right. And we have the technology to get it right. I mean, the technology is the oldest technology in the world. It's essentially photosynthesis to draw carbon into soil. Now, that's a little bit of a metaphor or a little bit of a crude analogy, because there are other ways other than photosynthesis to get carbon back into soil. And grazing in a holistic manner is one of those methods where if you use and employ the right techniques with livestock, you can start to take degraded land and make it healthy again by virtue of certain techniques. It's probably outside the scope of this podcast, but there's a number of ways we can use our global volume of soil to sequester way more carbon than exists in the atmosphere. So I think it's important for people to understand that that's one point about soil carbon that's crucial.
So the economics have to be favorable, but unfortunately, in many cases, the cost of monitoring remains an impediment. That said, it's not just the economic benefits that we're after with the sequestering of carbon. Many of these practices also have big benefits to productivity. It's this virtuous cycle that Ben is really excited about.
The other thing that, of course, occurs is that our soils become more healthy, because soils need carbon. The higher the carbon content of soils, the more productive they are. And if we have more productive soils, we've got better crop yields, and not only better crop yields, but healthier crop yields. So we're talking about a very, very virtuous cycle here that doesn't just exist to reduce emissions and pay land owners for doing so. It starts to feed in to an extremely productive and healthy food system. And you really are creating a new version of events if, as you point out, you can ensure that it's verifiable, ensure that these results are actually happening and no one's gaming the system. You've created a very, very interesting positive feedback loop.
One of the best examples today of a scheme where we can certify on-farm practices and connect these practices to consumers is with Organic. But as we've heard previously on the podcast, organic certification can be cost prohibitive for farmers. And another challenge is that we don't always have ways to verify if the practices are better for the environment. To us at AgVentic, this seems like an opportunity where technology can play a big role. I asked Ben for his thoughts as well.
That's interesting. I think 2 comments. One is that I think you're seeing a lot of evidence out of the US and here in Australia. We know some guys who are doing a lot of good work in this space. You're seeing a lot of evidence. You're creating a much healthier and higher yielding and therefore more profitable food production system by ensuring that your soils are healthier. So again, it's probably outside the scope of this podcast, but I'm more than happy to continue the conversation or indeed, you know, provide some links back to some information on that front.
Do you mean about organic or about the soil carbon?
Yeah, I mean both okay. When it comes to organic farming, holistic farming, biodynamic farming, regenerative farming, that whole non-industrialized model of farming. I think there's a lot of evidence out there which would suggest that it's worth doing what it takes to convert to organics or convert to biodynamics or indeed spend some more money to ensure that your farm transitions away from an industrialized model, which is very expensive and risky and socially divisive in certain parts of the world. But I think if you look at the science and you look at the economics and the evidence that's starting to emerge, it absolutely makes sense. And there's guys who are much more involved and have more expertise in those levels of detail than I do. The second point I'll make, though, which is really interesting one that you raise is how do you connect consumers to this story? And that's a great segue into the next business that we're getting involved with and raising capital for.
Ben is talking about a business called Tasman Environmental Markets. Their mission is to connect consumers and corporates with projects globally that have emissions reductions outcomes.
So this business, most people would be familiar with the idea of ticking a box when you fly on an airline, fly carbon neutral. When you go on the Qantas website, for example, and you tick fly carbon neutral, that has been enabled and created by this business that we're investing into, that we're really excited about. That's been done, of course, with the help and the assistance of Qantas, who are really driving this space forward from an airline industry perspective and a corporate perspective here in Australia. That's one way where we can start to see consumers, by ticking that box, being able to do two things. One, lower their own footprint from flying, and two, connect with projects that our guys have been able to procure carbon from, and you start to see a really powerful solution to climate change and emissions reduction outcomes.
I asked Ben about one of the arguments I've heard against this kind of approach. Basically, is buying an offset the same as paying to absolve your sins? You've still committed the sin, so is this really a good intervention?
Yeah, we get asked that all the time. That's a great question. We've thought about it very deeply because we want to make sure that what we do and where we flow our opportunities and capital into have those outcomes. So there's a couple of comments I'd make. One is that for a business like this one, the more it scales, the more it is able to channel in terms of corporate and consumer dollars into projects. If you believe, as we do, that the projects that they're touching are very real, the more outcomes you are having on land and on communities. And the founders give a really beautiful example of one of the projects that they've looked at and continually looking at and have invested in Papua New Guinea, where they've traveled to and spent time with communities in really wild, remote locations and have seen the outcomes of the investments that are being made into those regions. These communities are not only getting paid to protect native forest and rainforest, but indeed that's what's happening. In other words, that native rainforest is there as a carbon store going forward, and it is not able to be cleared, is not able to be cut down. There are community benefits that are enormous to the locals who are able to sustain themselves and continue to exist in that land and on their land. And the direct result of this business connecting consumers and corporates with those projects is that you are not only having the carbon sequestration outcomes and protection of huge amounts of biodiversity, but you've got communities that are able to connect back with that on the ground and receive income for doing it. There's another example where that's happening in New Zealand for some of the First Nations there. So that's one comment I'll make. If we tick the box, and I don't mean in the carbon neutral sense, but if we tick the box that we believe these companies and these founders are actually ensuring via due diligence and verification that the projects that they're procuring carbon from or indeed promoting are very real, then by extension, every dollar that we put through that ends up creating and enabling these type of outcomes. And it scales these abatement processes enormously in our view. The second comment I'll make is that perfection can be the enemy of progress. And if we wait to get a system that is perfect, well, we already know that it's too late. So we need to ensure that we're behaving in a responsible manner in relation to the projects we're talking about here. But again, if we sign off on that and we agree all of those projects are real, and they could be a wind turbine project in India generating renewable energy, that's another way that you can get paid because you're avoiding generation of energy from fossil fuels. And if we believe that in promoting these sectors, by connecting them with consumers and corporates, contribute to emissions reductions, which we know they do. We know wind farms and solar farms, protection of forests, many other methodologies do have those effects. Then we need to get going on it. And that's what I mean by perfection is the enemy of progress. So we are saying, look, like using your church example, if you are a large corporate emitter and you are the devil and you are pumping and bilging smoke and pollution and CO2 equivalent into the atmosphere, and you know that you're going to have to transition away from that in the next 10, 20, 30 years, because that's just where the world's headed. We know that too. Fossil fuels are on the way out. But there is a transition that is and needs to take place. No one can or would suggest that we can turn off every coal plant tomorrow. We know that it's going to take time. And if you add up the emissions trajectory or the emissions output from all of those coal producers or gas producers over the next 10 years, say, let's say that's the transition, and that adds up to a certain amount of carbon that's being spilt out to the atmosphere, and we do nothing with respect to offsetting, we have our emissions and we know what that volume is in 10 years' time. If we do something and we allow those corporates to offset, knowing that in any event they're going to transition because they have to and they will, maybe it's 15 years rather than 10. If we allow offsetting to occur, and as I said before, we ensure that the projects are real and valid, then your net emissions profile, it will inherently has to be lower at the end of that transitional period. For those 10 years, you've ensured that you've protected a certain amount of rainforest, you've built a certain amount of renewable energy, you've sequestered a certain amount in soil carbon projects, you've paid for reductions in sediment and nitrogen runoff into the barrier reef, because that's another example of where you can put your money. Clearly, from our point of view, my personal point of view, we're achieving something really important. And whilst I get it, that there is a bit of a syndrome amongst humans, that yes, if we pay for our sin, we can just go and sin again and pay for it again, or we can feel better about just doing that and then continuing to emit. I get that syndrome. However, we have to find a way to connect people who want to connect with those projects who otherwise can't do it. And there are a number of people that will do both. In our view, you'll start offsetting and you'll start reducing at the source. And I think both are incredibly important. I think it's very difficult to determine what is more important. Is it more important to offset globally now, or is it more important to reduce and mitigate in the first place? Not mitigate against it, but mitigate in the first place. So, yeah, we can then start getting into economic conversations about, you know, when the cost of abatement is high enough, will people emit in the first place? And there's a very strong argument there too. So we need these carbon markets, in my view. We need companies that are able to connect consumers with this market. We need people to be able to simply trade in environmental markets and products that end up having these outcomes, because I do believe that that's a way we can transition our economy. And it's not perfect, but if we don't start, it all gets a bit late.
Ben is really hopeful about the future, especially as we can continue to be quantitative to measure impact and use economic incentives to drive change. This will help to continue to move away from stereotypes about impact being for bohemians and hippies. For Ben, measurement is critical, and the concept of a CO2 equivalent is a good example.
So a ton of carbon dioxide equivalent is a ton of carbon dioxide equivalent is a ton of carbon dioxide equivalent, no matter where you are. A ton of carbon dioxide in the soil in Australia, if measured correctly, is the same as a ton of carbon dioxide in the soil in Malaysia, which is the same as in South America, which is the same in the UK. A megawatt hour, which is broadly equivalent to a ton of carbon. So a megawatt hour of renewable energy, which is broadly equivalent to a ton of CO2e, is the same whether it's from a wind farm project in India or a wind farm project or a solar project in Queensland. And it's therefore quite ubiquitous and measurable and tradable. So we have a unit of measurement that is inherently linked and related to the health of the planet, that if dealt with fairly and equitably and commercially, creates enormous outcomes both for wealth creation for investors and for planet. Because, as I said before, if these projects are working, then there is a benefit to environment, an enormous one, and to communities. So I think it's a really important concept. It shifts the conversation away from the what if or the maybes or the we'll get the qualitative conversation around impacts to a completely quantifiable, a completely commercial, and a completely tradable conversation. And that's why we say, well, you don't have to be a convert to the green economy. This is just a new normal. This is just the way this is going to function. And so if you wake up in the morning not really caring so much about nature of the environment, I think we've seen that recently happened in this country at the election, both from voters and politicians, then if we've created a new normal, it doesn't much matter, because everybody going to work and everybody consuming will be inherently connected to these regenerative outcomes rather than these extractive outcomes. That's ultimately where we're headed and where we're aiming to head.
I love that the point you made before, like you, it's not just that it's normal for people and we don't have to think about it in our day-to-day decisions, but also that it's profitable for different projects and especially for farmers, because without that aspect, then, you know, you can't get those economics to work. And so I so appreciate the focus on that, because so much of this conversation often misses the expense at the end of the line for the people making the change.
Yeah, that's right.
Ben, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate this. I definitely asked things that are interesting to me, and hopefully we'll find a way to make them interesting to the audience. So I really appreciate
thank you.
And hearing your view on this.
It's good to kind of speak out loud about it, to be honest. It's really helpful for me too.
Oh, well, anytime. These are my favorite topics to think about, so I'm more than happy to chat.
Fabulous. Excellent. Really appreciate it. Love your work. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of AgTech So What. You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.